Oh my goodness. Hi, this is Patsy with the Z. My goodness, there, I got all caught up because I think I'm so excited. This is amazing. This is Patsy with a Z, and I am so happy to welcome everybody to Joy on Paper today because this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And boy, oh boy, do I have two of the greatest writers, global best-selling authors, Lee Child and Andrew Child. And everybody who listens to my program knows that I am always talking about both of them. And it's always so exciting to have them on the program. We had Lee last year. It was his birthday. And it was really exciting. And we're very close to his birthday again. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey, Patsy. Yeah, doing well.
Oh, wow.
Good morning, Patsy. It's great to hear your voice.
Wow. Now that I got it back, I was so excited there for a few minutes. This is thrilling. You know, the new book, of course, is out. It was out 2 days ago, and it's called Better Off Dead, another exciting Jack Reacher book. And so I always feel like I have three guests here. I have you two, and Jack Reacher somewhere around. I think he's around all over the world now, like every 30 seconds since. In 3 seconds, I think people are buying a book. And so Jack Reacher's like floating around out there.
He sure is. He's out there. Everybody, this week, I love this week because everybody's reading the new story, you know, probably right now, today. And it's very exciting to contemplate how are they going to react to it, you know?
Oh, well, they always get so excited. People get so excited. They pre-order this way in advance. It's like Mary Higgins Clark always told me it was so much fun. She would have all these pre-orders, and she'd say, you know, it's such an honor that I have so many fans who love me. And, of course, that's the same with you guys. The fans love these books and love the stories, and Jack Reacher is alive and well and keeping us always interested and excited. And it was funny, I was with the new book, which is a story set this time near the Mexico border. And which one of you wants to explain it just quickly? Do you have your standard statement you want to make about this book?
Andrew is best at this part.
Well, I don't know about that. Yeah, I mean, this book was, you know, it's the second one that Lee and I have written together. And so we've learned a little bit about how we best work with each other. But with this one, we talked a little bit about the story and what we thought might happen, how it might feel, where it might be set. But then I suddenly, you know, one day out of nowhere, I had this picture in my head of how the book might open. And you know, when you've got a partly formed idea, you know, it's so delicate, it's so fragile, you don't really want to talk about it because sometimes that's all it takes to crush it and destroy it. So I thought the only thing to do is try to get it down on paper, see if it works, and if I'm happy with it, then I'll send it to Lee and see what he thinks. So I came up with this idea for this opening scene. As you say, Patsy, it's on the border between Arizona and Mexico, and you know, something that had never happened in a Jack Reacher book before, and I wanted to see how it would work. So I sent it to Lee, and he can take it from there.
Yeah, the way it sort of appeared to me was that Andrew had written it in secret, and then he was trying it out on me. But I completely understand what he says. There are certain ideas that seem so great, but you need to put them down on paper to see if they actually mechanically work. So that's why he did it. And he was satisfied with it, obviously, and he sent it to me, and I thought, wow, what a knockout. This was an absolute killer of an opening. And I felt really happy about it, first of all, because if you get a great opening, then the rest of the book is that much easier to do. And if you get a great opening, too, then it gives the book a different appeal. You know, the reader is in it immediately. From the very first page, there's no slow burn. It's right in there, and we had a lot of fun doing it. But going back to what you just said about pre-orders, you know, the book trade from the inside has changed tremendously, because in the old days when I was starting out, we would try not to say anything about the book, because you had to pack it all into the week of publication to catch the commercial wave. But now with pre-orders, it doesn't matter when the book is mentioned, because if somebody hears about it and is intrigued, then they can go and pre-order it 6 months in advance. But the problem for us is that because we're readers ourselves, and obviously we buy books ourselves, we were getting these emails from Amazon and from Barnes & Noble and so on our personal accounts, saying, we noticed you bought a Jack Reacher book before. Would you like to pre-order this one? And we're sitting there thinking, well, we haven't written it yet. They start this process so far out that, the jacket is there in the email, and it's like really tempting people to buy it. And we're thinking, fantastic, except it isn't finished.
Yeah, and then that gets compounded when they have the special edition that we sign, because again, we get an email saying, buy this special signed edition. We're like, yeah, but we haven't signed it yet, let alone finished writing it. So, yeah, it certainly ramps up the pressure to get it done on time.
It sure does. The pressure feels enormous at that point. You've got three chapters and they're already selling it.
And of course, now, as usual, Jack is going to find somebody to save, and that comes off right at the beginning of the story. And tell us about this character that you've developed, somebody for Jack to save, because he's always there, and I think that's why we love him. He's going to...
Well, I'm going to start talking about Reacher in that exact situation, because again, this was Andrew's instinct, really, for the beginning of this book, that it has this fantastic, unbelievable first chapter, and then it really gets into the story. It kind of loops back and tells us how did we end up with what we've just seen. And Reacher is really skeptical about it. He comes across this woman, fantastically visual scene. Imagine the desert somewhere of Arizona, outside of a town, this endless expanse of desert. And there's one tree in like 1,000 square miles, and crashed into the tree is a Jeep, and sprawled across the steering wheel is this woman who we don't know. Is she alive? Is she dead? Reacher approaches to find out. And I think if it had been me doing it, I would have immediately sort of latched into a sort of short circuit, thinking, yeah, she needs help. But Andrew brings a more subtle perspective to it, which is that Reacher meets this woman and thinks, she's nuts. She's crazy. I want to get out of here. I want to run. And which is great, because, Reacher is not like a professional do-gooder. He'll do it if he feels like it. And at the beginning of this book, he doesn't feel like it, because she thinks this is some kind of nutcase. But he sticks around just long enough for it to become obvious, yeah, actually, this is a real problem.
Yeah, well, what I had in mind was that, one of the two big challenges you have when you are starting a book like this is that you have to have the coincidence which pulls your hero into the story, And this was the 26th time that Jack got pulled into somebody else's story. And, you get all the jokes, don't you, about if you were checking into a hotel and you saw Hercule Poirot checking in, the last thing you'd do would be stay in that hotel because you knew there was going to be a murder there, And so you've always got to find a way that it becomes plausible, that people are going to say, yeah, I can see how he would involve himself in that situation, especially since he's not a professional. If he was a detective or something, he'd be obliged to do something about it, but he's not. He would be free to walk on by if he wanted to. So I felt that this time around, the way that the cards the chips were stacking up, it just felt more natural that he would look at the situation and start out by saying, come on, wait a minute, really? Because that's what I would have done if I was in his shoes. So I think that, we were just trying to add in that little extra layer of plausibility there.
Well, the funny thing is, when I was reading it, I got to the line where I think it's page 5, and we've already, meeting the bad guys. And there's a line in there where you are, the bad guys are talking, and one of them says, I can't say the word. I don't think I can say the word on the radio live, so I'll say, and the line is, you were never going to take me to Michael. And then the bad guy says, no blanky blank, Sherlock. And I stopped at that point because for me, of course, knowing where you come from, when I read that, I thought, oh my goodness, shades of Birmingham. And immediately I thought of Birmingham, and of course, the whole, for me, it's very visual when I think of Birmingham, because I flew over Birmingham many times. When we lived in England, we had a plane that we flew out of White Waltham, and we used to fly all over England. So I saw a lot of England, you know, from the sky, and one of them was Birmingham. And I want to play a song for you and see if you recognize this song. Remember that song?
I have no idea what that is.
Well, you know, it's funny because I used to go to Birmingham a lot, as I said, because when I did some business there and I flew over Birmingham, and there was a friend there that I met who used to play this song because she used to hear it at the movie theaters. And so I thought perhaps you had heard it when you were kids.
We were too poor to go to the movies.
Really? That poor?
But it sounds like it has a kind of cool, like almost sort of World War II vibe to it. And you know, when you said something there about things you can't say on the radio. You know, when we were growing up in Birmingham, you know, we had this real sense of it being a place that made things, substantial things. And I remember going to a museum in St. Petersburg in Russia. Tasha was doing some book research there, so I went along, and I remember I was in this museum, and they had a photograph of tanks rolling off the production line in Birmingham that were going to be sent to the Soviets to help them fight the Nazis. And all in huge chalk letters down the side of every one of this in endless line of tanks rolling off the production line, the Brummies had written in chalk, you know, these encouraging messages to their, you know, to their sort of brothers in arms on the other side of the world. And many of those you couldn't repeat on the air either, funnily enough.
Well, of course, Birmingham was blitzed, as was Coventry. I think the anniversary of the Coventry blitzing is coming up in middle of November. And Jim, you were born in Coventry.
I was, and I remember I was born 9 years after World War II finished. And you got to remember that the economy, the whole culture was in a kind of slow motion phase. And we had enormous war debts. So as a matter of fact, the Midlands were working really hard. Employment was pretty full. The factories were humming. Everybody had a job. But all the money went to paying off war loans, principally to America. So that it was, people were working, but there was not much money around. And therefore, nothing got fixed. And even though I was born 9 years after the war, and so my first sort of kid memories are, let's say, maybe 12 years after the war, 13 years. It was still ruined. Everything was completely, there were bomb sites everywhere. The old cathedral was this burnt-out shell that we would visit on a Saturday morning on the way to the store. And just to see the progress on the foundations of the replacement cathedral that was being built, and it was symbolic of two things, really. One was how boring it was. That was the biggest attraction you could find for a Saturday. but also how symbolic it was that, you know, this was renewal and rebirth. And then by the time Andrew was born, all that, those years later, that phase was basically over. And World War II was a memory rather than just a physical representation in front of you. I mean, as a little kid, literally, I remember playing in ruined houses, and everybody had a collection of bomb shrapnel and stuff like that that you would find lying around, I mean, even all those years later. So yeah, but it was a period that evolved very slowly.
But even when I was a kid, you know, it was still part of the collective consciousness, and even part of the vocabulary. You know, you might say to somebody, "Oh, you're going to the football on Saturday. Where do you park?" And they would say, "Oh, on the bomb site on College Road." You know, because there were still things that hadn't been rebuilt. And as you'd have seen, perhaps, especially flying over towns like Birmingham, there were still every single major industrial town in the UK to this day. You can walk down pretty much any street and you will see gaps in the houses. You know, there'll be rows of identical houses and then there'll be a couple that are missing because they got bombed out. Or there'll be a couple that are, you know, obviously 30, 40 years newer because that's when they finally got around to building ones in the spaces. And it's just part of the landscape that you become used to.
Well, Sherlock, why I mentioned Sherlock is when I was in Birmingham, I went to Sherlock Street for a good reason, because somebody very famous lived in Birmingham, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And so there was talk that, you know, he named Sherlock Holmes after that street. So that's one of the places I walked to.
We love Sherlock Holmes in Britain, even though it's a very cautionary tale, really, because, as you know, Conan Doyle had very ambitious, high-flown ambitions for his literary work. He wanted to be regarded as a serious novelist, and he really didn't much like the Sherlock Holmes work, and he was very careless with it, unbelievably careless. You know, Dr. John Watson, who is the sidekick, he allegedly was wounded in the Afghan wars. And if you read through this canon, that wound kind of drifts around his body. Sometimes it's in his side, sometimes it's in his leg. And, you know, also the geography of London, when Sherlock Holmes rushes out to the street in Baker Street and he makes a left and he's like 5 miles away already. It was an odd series, fascinating, famous, influential, but he wasn't putting much care into it.
Certainly, when you were little boys, did you walk past his home where he lived? It was on Aston.
Well, we will have walked past it 100 times then on the way to the soccer, yeah.
Yeah, so there you were. Perhaps, you know, the whole mystery genre just got into your bones just by walking past the house.
Could have been.
I used to park in a street called Electric Avenue, which I thought was the greatest name for a street.
When you, of course, you know, one of the things that I traveled so much in Britain. That's what we did. I was always so excited to go new places and find. Well, my husband was happy to find new pubs. So we did a lot of traveling. That's why, for example, we were in St. Albans. we went there for the pub. And when I was in Birmingham, I did, you know, some touring around the city, and I was just reading recently, I don't know if you read British papers still, you know, the library, the new library. Have you been to the new library, the big one?
Yeah, I have. I've been a few times, and it's a fascinating building. It's really, really fabulous.
Well, I think it's architecturally, it's very fascinating. I think it's really great. And I know when I was in Birmingham, this was like 74, and I wanted to see the museum, well, not the museum, but the room that was designed for the Shakespeare collection. And most people don't know that the biggest Shakespeare collection in England is there in Birmingham.
Yes, it is, and that's because Shakespeare is right there, right in the Midlands. He was born not far from me. Stratford is pretty close to Coventry. And that then led to all kinds of things that still resonate today, which is that the Midlands in Britain are regarded as kind of very day class A, and everybody from there must be some kind of knuckle-dragging moron. And so that people in the rest of England cannot accept that Shakespeare can have come from such a place. So there's been this industry, really, of trying to pretend that Shakespeare was somebody else. And naturally, Andrew and I get really annoyed about that because, loads of great things come out of the Midlands. Birmingham especially was the greatest manufacturing city in the world for probably 100 or more years. It was in the 19th century, it was the Silicon Valley of the world. There were more patents issued in Birmingham in the first half of the 19th century than everywhere else in the world put together. It was an absolute powerhouse, full of smart, skilled, capable people. And yet the rest of the country looked down on it.
Well, as I said, I wanted to see, when I went there, I wanted to see the Shakespeare Library, but it was in transition. They were, they'd sort of taken the beautiful room apart and they were redoing something. So I never got to see that one designed by Chamberlain, which is an absolutely fantastic, takes your breath away.
Well, you know, they moved it lock, stock, and barrel
yeah.
to the new building.
Yeah, that's why. If I went back to England, that would be one of the places that I would want to see. I would want to go to Birmingham just to see that. And what I was mentioning about reading, I still read British papers. I don't read any American papers. Did you realize that they close the museum on Sunday, the library on Sundays now because they don't have money?
That's the problem with what's going on in Britain at the moment. In this country, states make certain decisions, but they get some federal support for certain types of activity. And the same applied in Britain. The local authority, the municipality in Birmingham, built the library expecting to get central government support for some of the funding, which was withdrawn by the wicked Tory government. And so almost as soon as it was open, it had to be closed for certain times of the week and so on. It's just a terrible catastrophe, really, and a weakness in the funding system.
Well, it brought tears to my eyes because, of course, I love libraries. Wherever I go, all over the world, I always look for two things. I'd always look for the American Embassy, and then I would look for the nearest library. And so I visited so many libraries all over the world. And when I read that they were closing it, and particularly on Sundays, when Sunday is the day that, so many people could go, it's heartbreaking.
It really is. I mean, especially, if you want to encourage people to read and to enjoy books. And, that library's brilliant. It's got all kinds of things in there. It's got old maps. It's got all kinds of local artifacts. The weekend is the natural time for people to go. So it's just terrible that it would be closed then.
It is, because, of course, libraries meant a great deal to both of you when you were young. Like me, I was poor. We didn't even have a library where I grew up. My library was actually the National Geographic magazines that we got to the house, because that's the those are the only books we got, other than comic books. So, but you guys went to the library a lot.
Yeah, we really did. It was, and the local library, the local branch, was where we started out. And I remember it so well. I loved reading. I mean, not that there was much else to do, but happily I loved reading. And I consumed books like crazy. The problem was that a kid was only allowed one library ticket, and that meant you could have one book for the week. And that wasn't enough for me, so my parents, who were kind of repressed and uncooperative about a lot of things, they believed in the value of reading. So we operated this sort of scam, like Chicago-style voting, where anybody who ever visited our house, we signed them up for a library ticket. And even our dog had a library ticket. And so that then I could get five or six books every week instead of one. And it was a lifesaver. It's so common to every writer you'll talk to that the library kind of created their life. That was how it happened for me. And I totally fell in love with that randomness because it was a small library, the branch, and it didn't have that many books, and it wasn't particularly curated in any way. It was just a random selection of books. And so I loved that feeling. We went on a Friday afternoon when we got home from school, and I loved that feeling of randomness. You didn't know what you were going to get. You didn't know what they were going to be like. And I miss that now, because being in the book trade myself now, nothing is random. You hear about everything ahead of time. You hear the buzz. You know what's coming. You know roughly what's what. And that element of randomness disappeared, and I miss it.
Of course, by the time you came along, Drew, you were a little, you know, a few years later, so probably there were a little bit more library access than by then.
Yeah, although it was the same library that I used to go to, and, you know, I can still remember the smell of it, you know, the layout. I remember, you know, being excited about going. It was, you know, really formative. And then when we moved to, we moved nearer to London and had to switch to a different library, you know, kids, I don't know, most kids, I suppose, me certainly, you know, I was kind of set in my ways. I liked my library, you know, I identified with it. That's where my books came from. And when we moved to this new town, and it was a completely different library, in many ways probably better, you know, bigger, better stocked, better organized, I didn't like it as much because it wasn't the one that I'd grown up with.
Now, did you, you know, for you, Jim, you were, of course, as you said, you know, not too long after World War II, when Winston Churchill was still alive.
And Winston Churchill was Prime Minister when I was born.
And the thing is, it's coming up now to the anniversary of course, people are already talking about the anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. And so many people don't, I don't think, quite understand that Winston Churchill was still alive when John Kennedy was killed. Winston Churchill didn't die until 1965.
That is correct, February 1965, and it really felt, just like I sort of said before, you know, the end of an era, the beginning of the next era. That period in Britain, say 65 through 67, was incredibly pivotal. It feels like a hinge in history now, especially 67, things started kind of moving forward to emphasize in a way that the old era had ended, possibly when Churchill died in 65. I remember that. That was my last year of elementary school. And, you know, Churchill was a big deal. And the thing that his speeches were obviously still very well remembered, especially that one from May 1940, the Our Finest Hour speech. An incredible speech, really. And very persuasive, which was a disadvantage for us kids, because we sort of understood the gigantic importance of World War II. The evidence was still all around us in terms of the ruined landscape and, it must be said, wounded veterans. And it was all over. It had clearly been a huge deal. And yet we had not participated in it. And it felt to us like history was over. There was nothing for us. All the good stuff was in the past. And you couldn't argue with that. You know, the triumph in World War II was an immense achievement, achieved at awful cost for six long years. You couldn't argue against it, but you felt disappointed that you'd missed it and there was nothing for you now in your life. And that was a serious feeling until around that period, you know, 63, when the Beatles started up. And then let's give it 10 years, 63 to 73. Completely changed everything.
And, of course, right away you remembered when Winston Churchill died. Did you do you remember when John Kennedy was killed? Because that also impacted England. I think a lot of people in England were very interested in that.
I remember it very well. My dad was out, I think, at some kind of business thing, and my mother was next door babysitting, and I was in the house watching the television. There was a quiz show on British television on that night that I was watching. And I remember in the first half of the show, before the commercial break, there was a news flash saying Kennedy has been shot. And then in the second half of the show, there was a second news flash saying he is dead. And something about it, I was only young at that time, you know, nine? And I knew it was of burning importance. So I went next door to tell my mother. And my parents were very, very upset. And I couldn't quite work out why, because actually they were relatively anti-American, you know, like a lot of traditional Brits. And they were hysterically anti-Catholic because of my father's ethnic background as a Protestant in Northern Ireland. And so you wouldn't have expected them to be that upset about it, but they were devastated. And years later, I asked them, what was it that bothered you so much about that? And they said it was because he was the first world leader of our generation. And that meant a huge amount to them, because looping back to World War II, they felt they had been led into all that trouble by the senior generation. And they were sick of that. They wanted to run the world themselves. And Kennedy being, you know, he was born in 1917 and the first president to be born in the 20th century, the first world leader really to be of any significance that was born in the 20th century. And he was their guy. You know, it was their generation that had to clean up the mess. They trusted themselves more than the older generation, which was actually a surprise culturally, because usually they were very deferential about hierarchy, especially age, you know, respects your elders. But they did not respect their elders because of the trouble they'd caused.
Well, you know, do you read Winston Churchill? Have you read a lot of his works?
I have, actually, yeah.
And I've been, you know, thinking a lot about Churchill lately, what with people wanting to take down his statue. And it's heartbreaking, because I don't think, you know, this generation does not understand what would have happened to England if Lord Halifax had become the prime minister. It would have been devastating.
Well, obviously, that's a great point. And I think also people want everything to be either red light or green light. What Churchill really totally illustrates is how complex history is. Here is a guy who was wrong about everything in the 20th century, except for the one thing that really mattered. And people need to embrace that. Yeah, it's confusing. It's complicated. Nobody is all one thing or the other thing.
But boy, oh boy, if you think about it, if we would have had Halifax, it would have been a disaster for England, that's for sure.
It really would. I mean, I don't know if... one of the things I'm really interested in is the whole Cambridge spies, all of that stuff. And, Halifax wound up being the British ambassador to the United States. And he played a role, basically, in fumbling the uncovering of the spy ring. And that was largely due to, you know, as so often is the case in the UK, down to his kind of prejudice about class, because the Cambridge spies were all relatively upper class people, and when it became clear that there was a leak coming from somewhere, he just couldn't comprehend that it would be somebody from that class. He was convinced it must be one of the servants or one of the employees. So if you imagine the damage that he could have caused on a scale, on a stage that was exponentially larger, it could have been, you know, it would have been horrifying.
It would have been. It would have been, I think, devastating. This is what one of the things, I love history so much. And, of course, I love British history. And so a particular question to you, Drew, having a wife who is Tasha Alexander, who loves British history, and, you know, again, an American, like I am, you know, I moved to England when I was 21 years old so I could live near where Jane Austen was born. And Tasha has that same excitement about British history. What has she taught you about British history that you didn't know yourself?
Well, I think really with Tasha, it's almost sad, honestly, because I think I've kind of spoiled her view of England because, you know, right from the first night we met and she discovered I was English, I had to say to her, listen, it's not what you think. You know, we're not Mr. Darcy and cream tea. You know, we're horrible. We're savages. And really, you'd be better off staying well away because none of the stuff that you think is true. And she, you know, she didn't believe me. And then over the years, you know, things have happened and situations have unfolded. You know, I always take such a sort of cynical view of things, you know, although we'll be out somewhere and we'll see a situation unfolding. And I just know that if that was unfolding in England, it would end up with someone in the hospital. And I'll say, okay, you know, watch out. And she'll say, what are you talking about? Nothing bad's going to happen. And of course, it doesn't. So I think more it's just a sort of, you know, I think that I've probably been a very bad influence on her when it comes to her, you know, her view of England and it and what the place is really like. But
the reality is nothing like. I remember when Andrew and I first went to a baseball game in the U.S. We went to the Yankees, and it was what they call Bat Day, which is one of those promotions. So Andrew said to me, "What's Bat Day?" And I said, well, it means that the first 14,000 attendees get a free replica bat. And he just looked at me in astonishment. And he said, if that happened at the Villa, there'd be 14,000 dead.
Well, yes. I was caught up once. I've mentioned to Drew before that I had a white Cadillac when I lived in England. And when I had never been, I used to drive my, I would drive into London, no problem. And I happened to be in England, in London, when a game ended. And I don't know who won that. Let's just say the street was full of people either celebrating or not celebrating a soccer match. And there I am in a white Cadillac by myself in London, a blonde girl, and there are these, what people would call hooligans, I think that's what you call them. And there, I mean, I'm right there, you know, near Piccadilly. And for a moment, I was like, I don't know, I got really a little bit scared. But they were such great guys. They were gentlemen. They cleared the way for me. They pulled people away from the street so I could get out of my parking spot. And they just loved it. They loved this white Cadillac. And they're all, you know, saying nice things to me. So that was after that, I learned never to be in town when there was a game ending. But that was my experience with football hooligans in England. They were gentlemen.
I can totally see that because, you know, not in relation to football, but other things in England, you know, what I've noticed with being there with Tasha is that if you come from a different group, like, you know, you're an American, then you're not treated the same way. You know, there are people that we've come to know over there who they literally would not speak to me if I was there on my own. But because Tasha's there, you know, that you get a pass. You know, all of the stuff that still is a problem in England in terms of social class, which part of the country you were born in, all of that stuff. You know, you get a free pass from that. And it's been quite informative watching it. You know, I almost feel like a sort of an observer in what was my own country, because then I can see how things work but from a different perspective.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned when you met Tasha, because of course you met her at a BoucherCon.
That's right.
And I met you both at a BoucherCon, and so BoucherCons are very important. And for you, Jim, your first BoucherCon was pretty sensational. What happened? What year was that? That was a 19...
Your
first one.
First book came out in 97.
Yeah, so it was...
So it was 98. was the first BoucherCon, and that was in Philadelphia. And yeah, it was great for me because the book had been nominated for a couple of debut awards, which it won. And so it was a delightful weekend for me. And I just thought, yeah, this is great. This is how BoucherCon works. And the first couple I really remember, I was hanging out with this group of authors. All of us were totally obscure. In fact, I would say that obscurity actually would have been a huge leap forward for any of us at that point. And we became friends. We hung around in this little group. And we had this kind of belief that surely, possibly, one of us would make it eventually. And that group was Michael Connelly, Dennis Lehane, Harlan Coben, Laura Lippman, George Pelicanos. And we had this belief, if we kept showing up every year writing books, maybe one of us would make it. And in the end, we've all made it. And that generation, and they were so supportive. You know, some of them had started before me by a couple of years, and you could pick their brains. And the sort of communal advice was fantastic, and the support and the camaraderie was wonderful. And I'm still friends with all of them, and it's amazing to look back 25 years. This is what happened.
Well, BoucherCon is one of the connections that we have. It's one of my golden threads that really it changed my life meeting you guys because I will say it was Tasha. Tasha inspired me. First of all, she's so gorgeous. And I got, when I first had her on the program, and I would get all these emails from people saying, oh my goodness, she's so gorgeous. And she's just like 25 years old or something like that. And I'd say, yeah, that's it. And it was so wonderful to talk to her. And so that string is really golden. And
it's great for me too. I mean, I'm not in front of Andrew. I'm not going to say she's gorgeous, but she's cute. You know, I don't want him to get worried. But what's really great about her is that she's a writer, and so I can be over there, and there's three of us together, where you don't have to feel awkward about your obsession with this adverb or that adjective or this punctuation. You know, you can be sitting there really struggling over where a comma should go. And normally in front of people, you feel ludicrous doing that. But in front of other writers, they understand.
And you can talk about similes and metaphors?
Absolutely. In a way that is natural and professional and necessary. And it's a relief. It's a comfort. And it's so hard when you're with people that are not writers because they don't get it.
And of course, you can also talk about words because words are very important and the understanding where words come from. And I know that's one of the things that, well, all three of you are interested in.
We are, and it's particularly important for Tasha because with writing historical fiction, you know, everybody thinks about the problems of avoiding anachronisms, you know, and a lot of that is obvious. You know, you don't want to have a machine that wasn't invented yet. You don't want to have a hotel that hadn't been built yet, all of those kind of things. But actually, she takes it to the level of not using words that weren't in common usage yet. So she spends hours, days going through the Oxford English Dictionary, looking at the history of the words and finding out, you know, when they came into popular use. You know, sometimes there'll be things, some of them are quite surprising. You know, there are things that Dickens was using that you wouldn't expect from that period of time. But if she can find a reliable source that says, yeah, they were in circulation, then she's happy because, you know, she wants the whole thing to be authentic.
Oh, you know, I have so many, you know, Drew, every time you're on, I have my, listeners send in questions, and I have so many, and we're running out of time. I'm going to just ask a few because they really have asked. Of course, Jack Reacher doesn't really care. He doesn't carry a weapon. He doesn't carry a gun with him. He's got that toothbrush. And which if you use it right, you could kill somebody with it. But you do have guns in your books. Do you first of all, do you practice with guns? And particularly now that we've heard this terrible story, recent story, but do you guys have guns and do you practice and do you have a favorite?
I don't have any. I'm way too irresponsible to own a gun. Within a week, I would have either shot somebody else or shot myself. So I stay away from them. But I'm fascinated by them. Birmingham, where we came from, was a mechanical manufacturing town, and there were gunsmiths there. In fact, my local pub next to my school was called the Gun Barrels, because it was on the site of a foundry that had actually made gun barrels. And, Birmingham Small Arms, BSA, made a lot of weapons, then motorcycles later. But so I'm very familiar with them, and I'm very interested in the tiny machine aspect of them. But in terms of actually using one, I don't need one. If I need food, I go to the grocery store. If I need to pacify somebody with a dispute, I'll do it.
Well, nobody's going to dispute with you. You're tall enough and scary enough. I don't think so. What about you, Drew?
No, I mean, similar. I don't own any. I mean, I've used them. Our father was in the army, and he would talk. He would talk in a sort of fairly hypothetical way about guns, in terms of how they worked, common mistakes that people made with them, what you would do if you wanted to hit a moving target as opposed to a stationary target, things like that. And he was allegedly a pretty good shot, and apparently his father, who was also in the army, was supposed to be a good shot too. So just out of curiosity to see, whether or not it was a kind of genetic hereditary thing, I've been to shooting ranges and I've fired guns, and out of curiosity I've wanted to see what's the difference between firing different kinds, how do they feel in your hand.
Okay. Well, kind of thing. I slept with an Uzi under my bed for 30 years. and when I want to talk guns, I get John Giltstrap on.
Right.
Because he knows guns. And
I did a simulator thing for the FBI one time. I was a guest of honor at some conference where there was it was bringing together police and writers to learn from each other, and they had this gigantic simulator with this kind of surrounding IMAX screen on which this scenario was going to unfold, and you had in your hand a real Glock, but it had a sensor for where it was pointed, and so it was basically, it wasn't firing anything, it was hooked up to the computer. And they said, you've got to deal with this terrorist situation that's going to unfold on the screen. And I ended up getting maximum points, but only because I thought to myself, as I was starting out, I thought, this is a story. Somebody has composed this. It's scripted. And so because it wasn't real life, I thought, I'm going to approach it like a storyteller. What would I do to make this a difficult situation? And obviously I would have an innocent hostage pop out at one point who you mustn't shoot. And then you've got to have the bad guy pops out, you do shoot. And then you end up fighting your way through all these rooms and you end up in the last room. And obviously there's going to be an obvious target in front of you, but the real threat will be off to the side somewhere. And so I felt, because I was a storyteller fighting a storyteller, that's why I did so well.
Oh, the time has gone so fast, and we didn't get beyond page 5 of the new book, Better Off Dead. We need more time. You guys have to promise to come back. We'll have another. We have to have another hour. We can just talk books, because I wanted to just compliment you, Jim, on the blurb that you gave for Jonathan Santloffer's book. I thought that was so right on. I thought that was the most perfect blurb for The Last Mona Lisa.
Yeah, that's a great book and a great guy.
Yeah, he was on 2 weeks ago, and we talked about you. We talked about you guys. We talked about both of you guys because, of course, he loves you and loves the stories, and he was most appreciative of that wonderful blurb because he really was born to write The Last Mona Lisa. Just like you guys were born to write this number 26 in the Jack Reacher. Oh, and we didn't even get to talk about the streaming video. And you went to see part of the production, right?
I did, and it's fantastic. And pretty soon we're going to get the announcement of when it's going to launch. And I think it won't be too long.
Oh, will you come back on and talk to my listeners about it when we have the date? Because then we can talk more Jack Reacher. We can talk more books. It's going to be fantastic. Everybody's looking forward to it because this, I know that you have somebody who looks like our image of Jack Reacher, sort of a bulkier version of you. Somebody really, right? Tall, handsome, with beautiful blue eyes.
Considerably bulkier than me. In fact, his biceps are bigger than my head.
I've seen some pictures of him, and wasn't it fun to be on set again?
Yeah, because for me that's like going home. You know, I started out in television, and the interesting thing. It's huge, like a movie. You know, the budget is huge. They built the entire town on a backlot in order to shoot in it. But it's done fast. Television's done so much faster than movies. You know, you do eight scenes a day instead of two. And it was energy, and they were all good. It was one of those situations where it turned out absolutely as good as you hoped it would, except even better, because some of the supporting casts are fantastic. So, yeah, I'm thrilled with it.
Well, I know all of my listeners are thrilled with it. People around the world. Do you realize that the two of you are so powerful now, so important, and read by leaders all over the world, not just, you know, American presidents, but presidents all over the world, leaders all. You could hold a summit. You could get a summit. You could get people together and, you know, do something because everybody would love to be with you.
We're too busy writing the next one because they're already selling it.
Oh, that's funny. That's great. And yes, and I'm sure people are already pre-ordering it. They will be. And you guys are just terrific. I want to thank you both. And I have to say Lee Child and Andrew Child because they put Andrew Child on. But to me, you're Drew. And thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. I skipped all the commercials. I skipped everything. And as you know, Jim, in the business world, they think of that. But you're just, it's just so wonderful to talk to you. I've got exactly, they're looking, Big Ed in the control room is looking at the clock, and I've got exactly 20 seconds, and I have to say bye-bye to you guys.
Bye. Lovely talking to you.
Okay.
Patsy, thank you.
Okay, thank you guys. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Deborah Rodriguez. President Biden is speaking at the White House right now on a slimmed-down version of a budget plan he pushed for on Capitol Hill during a meeting with divided House Democrats this morning.
It's a framework that will create millions of jobs, grow the economy, invest in our nation and our people, turn the climate crisis into an opportunity and put us on a path not only to compete, but to win the economic competition.
Mr. Biden says the price is right.
It's fiscally responsible. It's fully paid for. And over the next 10 years, It will not add to the deficit at all.
Correspondent Ed O'Keefe is at the White House with a closer look at the revamped package.
We're looking now at a $1.75 trillion proposal that will include the largest investment ever to fight climate change, an expansion of pre-kindergarten programs for 3 and 4-year-olds across the country, an extension by 1 year of that child tax credit that so many Americans have been enjoying each month. There is Medicare coverage for hearing, universal pre-K.
What there isn't, paid leave, dental coverage for Medicare recipients, or free community college. Mr. Biden delayed a flight to Europe today in hopes of getting the bill passed while he's away. There is no confirmation at this point on whether he's won over those wavering Democrats he needs to get the job done. U.S. economic growth came to a screeching halt in the July to September period. It slowed to an annual rate of 2%. Bankrate's Mark Hamrick.
A so-called disappointing reading is consistent with the long-term trend in the United States. It's likely only a fairly temporary speed bump caused by the global traffic jam of goods.
New unemployment claims have hit another pandemic low, and a new report finds that COVID is changing what kind of jobs people want. Here's CBS's Elaine Cobb.
Child care and home health jobs are among the least popular right now, despite there being lots of opportunities as many go back to the workplace. A new report by job site Indeed says interest is surging in jobs in IT, civil engineering, and media.
The report also finds workers have rare bargaining power right now. Witnesses on an American Airlines flight from JFK to John Wayne Airport in L.A. say a passenger attacked a flight attendant in first class or business in a dispute about wearing a face mask.
There was a doctor on the flight, luckily, so I don't know. He said it wasn't broken, but it was bleeding, so they took her to the hospital.
The plane made an emergency landing in Denver so the flight attendant could get off. American has banned that violent passenger for life. The FAA says it's investigating. The Dow is up 137 points. S&P ahead 32. This is